Well, the second chapter of the Shvetashvata Upanishad is going to describe the process of yoga meditation by which one realizes the supreme soul in the heart. The process that's going to be described is pretty much the same as that which is explained by Patanjali Rishi in his Yoga Sutras. The Ashtanga Yoga, 8-step method of yoga meditation. But first, before the actual explanation of the process begins, there is a series of prayers offered to the Lord in the heart, praying for. And actually, these five first verses of the second chapter are directly quoted from the original Yajurveda. We understand the Upanishads are parts of the Veda. They're special portions. Each different Veda has its own Upanishads. And the Upanishads explain the higher significance of the Vedic mantras from a philosophical and spiritual point of view, not just ritualistic. The Yajurveda has, I think, 20 different branches. This Shvetashvata Upanishad officially belongs to the Taittiriya branch of the Yajurveda. But it also, these first five verses also show up in the another version of the Yajurveda called the Vajrasayani. Because these five prayers are original Vedic mantras, they're appearing in a more old-fashioned kind of language. Vedic language is not exactly the same as what is called classical Sanskrit, the kind of Sanskrit the Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita are written in. It's more stylized. The kind of language that prayers are written in. Just like very old Latin. The liturgy of the Catholic Church is written in a very old style of Latin. And people kept on writing books and speaking in Latin throughout the Middle Ages, even up to the 18th century. It was the language of education in Europe. So there were many different styles of Latin. The Latin of the Old Testament, that the Old Testament and New Testament were translated into, was more old-fashioned style than someone writing a scientific textbook in the 18th century would have written it. Similarly, the Sanskrit of the Bhagavatam is different style, different dialect than the Sanskrit of the Vedas. And so we'll get a sense of this. Especially these prayers are not in ordinary shloka form. They're in Vedic meters, which are not always symmetrical. Each line is not always the same length. And sometimes the verses have three lines, four or five or six, not four necessarily. Okay, so we'll start with the first verse, which is, first five verses are in the white Yajurveda, Vajrasayana Yajurveda. They are verses 1 through 5 of the 11th chapter of the white Yajurveda. The Yajurveda, let me introduce the Yajurveda. The Yajurveda is especially the Veda that describes sacrifice. The priests of the Yajurveda are the priests that take care of all the physical paraphernalia of the Vedic sacrifice. They're compared to magicians or sorcerers that create magic. By chanting these different mantras of the Yajurveda, the Advaryu priests turn ordinary objects into something of mystical, sacrificial significance. Just like they take an ordinary stick and chant a mantra, the very first mantra of the Yajurveda. Ishe Twa Urje Twa, short mantra. It's addressed to a stick from a palasha tree, from a small branch of a palasha tree, which you have to break off of the tree before you perform the daily pravargya sacrifice that every initiated Brahmin has to perform morning and evening. That sacrifice involves an offering of boiled milk, not of ghee, but boiled milk, morning and evening. In the morning, it's offered to Indra. And so, in order to cook, to boil, to make the offering, you have to chase the calf away from the mother cow so he doesn't drink all the milk. A stick is required for that. But this is not ordinary cow herding activity. This is a sacred ritual. It has a transcendental significance. So therefore, you have to have a sacred stick. That stick is made sacred by the mantra. The Yajurveda priest creates the transcendental situation out of ordinary physical things by chanting the proper mantras. So it's a kind of magic. He creates the sacrifice out of ordinary physical elements. That's the role of the Yajurveda priest. Okay, so these are Yajurveda mantras, but they're very devotional, addressed to the supreme controller of the universe, who is called Savita. Of course, we chant the Gayatri Mantra, those of us who have it, every day. Three Savana, three times a day. It's addressed, the first Gayatri Mantra is addressed to Savita, Savitur Varenya, the effulgence of Lord Savita. Savita is understood in the more literal sense, what the dictionary says the first meaning is, as the sun god. You know, it's supposedly a meditation on the Lord of the sun. But there is a higher understanding that Savita means the supreme Lord, the super soul, because Savita also means literally impeller or inspirer, one from the verb su, to impel, to push. So the one who gives the impulse of intelligence in every person's heart, that is Savita, the Supreme Lord. Okay, so I'll read the first verse. These, in the Yajurveda, these verses have particular intonations, but I have not written them down here, so I can't chant them properly. Anyway, Yunjana Patamam Manas Tatvaya Savita Diya Agnim Jyotir Nichaya Pritivya Adya Bhavat. First, may the inspirer of intelligence build upon the earth the fire altar of spiritual light. May he thus engage our minds, directing them toward self-realization. Of course, this Vedic language is very figurative. It takes some interpretation to make sense out of it. The ancient sage Yaska, who wrote the original Vedic dictionary, the Nirukti, or a commentary on the Nirukti, he says that every mantra in the Veda can be interpreted on three different levels. And he calls the levels of interpretation adibhautik, adidaivik, adhyatmik, which basically means you can understand the Vedas as describing glorification of the forces of nature. You can understand it on a bare physical level. Just like a description here of the sun, building a fire on top of the earth. These are physical things, and it can be understood in those gross terms. That's adibhautic understanding. You can also understand everything in terms of the presiding demigods who are controlling these natural phenomena, that the Vedas are glorifying and describing the power of the demigods. And that's the more apparent meaning of the Vedas. You read the Big Veda, it seems like it's glorification of dozens of different demigods. Only those who are very skeptical will think that the Vedas were written by people who were very primitive and were worshipping the forces of nature with no spiritual understanding at all. That's a gross interpretation. common understanding is that it's demigod worship. But there's a higher interpretation, a third interpretation called adhyatmic, or spiritual. Understanding the one supreme spirit, of whom these demigods are just representatives of his personal powers. Indra is personification of the active power of the Supreme Lord, his physical strength. Indra is manifest in the arms of the Supreme Lord. And so on. All the demigods are borrowing the powers and even the names and personalities of the Supreme Person. Okay, so let's look at this mantra. Yunjana patamam manas tatvaya savita diyaha agnim jyoti unichaya prithivya adhyabharat. Translation again, first may the inspirer of intelligence build upon the earth, the fire altar of spiritual light. May he thus engage our minds, directing them towards self-realization. This is a prayer to God, to the Supreme Soul, Savita, the inspirer of everybody's intelligence. No demigod has a right to that title. Demigods have various powers, but they're limited. The one person who controls everyone's intelligence and everyone's senses, that is Rishikesh, the Supreme Lord. So the prayer is for success in tapas, in this spiritual discipline, sense control. Because this sense control, this is Rang Ramanuja's explaining here, in the Sri Vaishnava commentary, sense control, tapas, is important, is required for success in realizing the Paramatma in one's heart. Without controlling one's senses, one cannot realize God. A special spiritual potency, mercy potency, is required for the Lord to be seen within the heart. He has to bestow his potency, his mercy. The other demigods, they had the power to give us the ability to perceive material objects in this world and to manipulate it and exploit material objects. That kind of power is given by demigods. But only the Supreme Inspirer can bestow the power to see Him, the Supreme, in the heart. Therefore, this prayer has spiritual significance. It's not a mundane prayer, although it could be misinterpreted. The real understanding, this is addressed directly to the Supreme Soul with the purpose of requesting of Him His mercy, so that the devotee can have transcendental realization. And that's symbolized here in terms of Vedic sacrifice. This is appropriate because the Upanishads come out of their explanations of the original Vedas. And the Vedas at least seem to be ritualistic. The people who are generally interested in the Vedas are ritualistic Brahmins. So when we begin explaining spiritual reality in the Upanishads, the language and the metaphors are still ritualistic, because that's the audience, ritualistic Brahmins. You know, it's explained in terms they can understand. So here's a metaphor of building the fire altar on top of the earth. This actually goes back into the Yajurveda, where there's description how to build the altar for the soma sacrifice. This is a more complex kind of sacrifice. Not just the sacrifice you perform in your own house every day, or once a month, or twice a year. But this is a special public sacrifice that involves many priests, 16, 17 priests, and a lot, it requires expensive paraphernalia. And you have to build a special altar out of special bricks. And just like there's one version of the summer sacrifice that lasts for 12 days. Not the most complicated, not the least complicated. The least complicated lasts one day. The most complicated soma sacrifice lasts 1,000 years. That was attempted last time, 5,000 years ago, by the sages at Naimisharanya. And as far as we know, they didn't even finish it. They couldn't even finish it. The last time this 12-day sacrifice was performed was in 1975 in South India, Kerala. and professors from University of California recorded it, made video recordings and so on. Last time this may ever be performed in Kali Yuga, even the 12-day solar sacrifice. And it requires, even the 12-day sacrifice requires building an altar out of 1,024 bricks of various shapes, five layers representing the five koshas, the five material coverings of the soul. By building this altar and performing the whole sacrifice and chanting all the mantras and making the oblations, the person who sponsors the sacrifice attains his spiritual identity, or at least he goes to heaven. The altar, in one version, the version that was performed back in 1975, the altar is built in the form of a bird. Because the sponsor of the sacrifice, on whose behalf it's performed, his soul takes wing and goes to heaven, like a bird. Anyway, very complex. There's dozens of mantras to be chanted for each individual brick, out of 1,000 bricks, and they have to be placed in exactly the right way, and all the rituals have to be performed perfectly right. This is alluded to here, this particular sacrifice called Agni Chayana, which means piling up Agni, building this complex altar out of bricks, is what is this metaphor is based on. The idea of building the altar on top of the earth, the complex ritualistic process of creating the sacrifice physically. There's a spiritual analogy built on that, that the yogi, the devotee, his own body is like the earth, and he's building the altar of his meditation, gradually, systematically, brick by brick. And on top of that altar, when it's completed, he can install the sacred fire, which is his spiritual realization, the realization of yoga. So the prayer is here. Let me purify my physical existence and my mental existence so that I can be prepared for proper spiritual realization. That's the prayer, the purpose of the prayer here. This is a three-line verse, typical Vedic. Yuktena manasavayam devasya savituksave suvargeyaya shaktya. The words are simple. The language is not very complex. Translation. With minds fixed in devotion, we engage in sacrifice to the effulgent Lord, our inspirer. We worship him to the extent of our capacity, so that we may attain his kingdom. Look at the words. Maybe you don't believe that this is a fair translation. Yuktena manasa. Yukta means engaged. The word, English word yoke has the same idea, same origin. Sava can mean various things. I translated it most literally as sacrifice. For the purpose of sacrifice to Deva Savita. The effulgent Lord. Deva is being used in this Upanishad to repeatedly mean the Supreme Person, the Supersoul. And literally, you could argue, well, Deva just means someone who shines. It literally means shining or playful. So it could mean anybody, but at least it means a person. It's not an impersonal concept when you use the word Deva. And Savita means the Supreme Inspirer, not just any person. So, for the purpose of offering sacrifice to Deva Savita, we, with fixed minds, engage Shaktya, which means to the extent of our capacity, according to our capacity. Here, Shakti means capacity. Suvargeyaya, dative case, means for the purpose of Suvarga, or Svarga, which you, if you want, you can translate as heaven. The Vaishnava commentators all insist, whenever the word Svarga comes up in the Upanishads, it means Vaikuntha, it means the spiritual world. It's not consistent to dedicate your devotion to the Supreme Person and then ask just to go to heaven, some temporary material thing. There's discussion, extensive discussion, of attainment of Svarga in the Katha Upanishad.
where the Brahmin boy Nachiketa visits Yamaraj on his planet. And he asks, teach me the sacrifice for going to heaven. And tell me what happens to people after after ultimate death. Do they still exist or do they cease to exist? So that could not mean that he's literally asking, do people go out of existence when they die, when their body dies? Because he's talking to Yamaraj. And, Yamaraj, every day, is processing people who have died and sending them back again. They don't go out of existence. He sends them to hell and then they go back to where they came from. So Nachiketa, if he's at all aware of who Yamaraj is, he wouldn't be asking that literally. But he means, when he says death, he means liberation. He's asking the question, is a liberated soul still exist as a person, or is his personal existence obliterated? That's an important question. And when he's asking about how to go to heaven, he's asking about ultimate liberation, how to go to the spiritual world. There's a definition here given by Ramanuja from, I don't know, doesn't say where. Sampurana explains the meaning of the word swar, or heaven, the proper meaning of it. It doesn't just mean material, temporary heaven. The definition is, Yadna dukena sambinnam nacha grastam anantaram abhilash opanitam yadi tatsukam svakpadaspanam. That place where you enjoy happiness that is not at all mixed with suffering in any way, that is not ruined, is not finished after some duration of time. And in that happiness one finds the fulfillment of all his desires. That is what is called swar, the place where you get unlimited, unending happiness. Not just some material, temporary place. So this is a devotional prayer. It's spoken in the plural, we, because all the sages present, or it's spoken by Shvetashvatara on behalf of all the sages. This is all their desire. They all have the same intention to achieve the Supreme. They're elevated sages, they're not contaminated by ordinary material motives. This word sada, I'll just make a comment on that. It literally means squeezing soma juice. Because, again, going back to the ritual of the Yajurveda, the soma sacrifice is the really important sacrifice, major sacrifice. And it involves, what makes it different than a more simple sacrifice, is that soma juice is offered, which is very rare. Not even all the demigods can have it. There's only 10 demigods who are allowed to drink the soma. And then a few of the priests in the sacrifice, 6 of them out of 16, and the sacrificer, the sponsor, they can drink the soma juice too. Apama somam amita abuma. And when you drink soma juice, you're guaranteed to go to heaven. And you can imagine that you're going to be immortal. So, this is a very vivid sacrificial image of the squeezing of the soma juice out of the soma plant. Sabhe. Sava means squeezing. The end of the second line of the prayer. Devasya savituk save. So sava literally means, going back to the ritualistic meaning, it means squeezing the soma juice out of the soma plant to be made in the offering. Yes, ma'am?
Well, this soma juice, the
original plant doesn't grow anymore in any one plant, so they have to use a substitute. But, if they're performing a bona fide version of the sacrifice, even the substitute will have the same sacrificial potency. Even, they don't have the same physical plant, but they're chanting the proper mantras, and they have some authority to make the substitution, then it works. So then that metaphorically is extended to the idea of any sacrificial offering. We offer sacrifice. Literally, it says we squeeze the soma juice Figuratively, it means we offer sacrifice. That same word, savanam, the act of squeezing the juice is called savanam. And when you perform a sacrifice, you do that squeezing of the juice 3 times every day. And it's done at sunrise, at noon, and sunset. The soma juice is offered 3 times each day of the sacrifice. So, figuratively, three savanam, which literally means the 3 squeezings of the soma juice, has come to mean the 3 junctures of the day, morning, evening, and morning, noon, and evening. And so we say that we chant our Gayatri Tri Savanam 3 times a day. It actually literally means that 3 times when the soma juice is squeezed. Anyway, there's the whole ritualistic Vedic imagery here, but it's a devotional prayer. Praying for the power to offer worship to the Supreme. We worship him to the extent of our capacity so that we may attain his kingdom for the purpose of attaining Swarga, or the eternal kingdom. Okay, moving on to number 3. Yes? Yes. That's their motive. Yes. Well, if we're correct in understanding this as the process of jnana mishra bhakti, and not the other way around, not just bhakti mishra jnana, not just jnana, impersonal jnana with a little bit of bhakti mixed in, but this, you know, this to all extents and purposes, this seems to be devotional service mixed with the motivation for liberation. Basically devotional, which means that these sages, they may not be realized to that extent at this point, but by going through this process, at least Shvetashvatara, their leader, he understands basically the significance of devotional service and the personality of God. And he's leading them to that understanding. So they're like, we can call them Shantabhaktas. They want a relationship, but more likely a neutral relationship. I don't know, it's hard to tell whether he personally has a higher realization or not. He's not presenting a higher realization. He alludes, we already read some allusion to attaining a spiritual body and having a personal relationship. But even that can be on a level of neutrality. At least we see strong signs of actual devotion here, of attaining one's spiritual identity, eternal personal spiritual identity, and having a relationship with the personal Supreme. It's not just merging, you know, and then obliteration. Just talk about relationship, about exchange, about devotion. And the word devotion occurs in the very last verse, bhakti. The Mayavadis use the concept of God as a stepping stone to become one with God, to usurp the position of God. We have such people walking on the streets here in Vrindavan. They're mixing with the Vaishnavas, but their motive is completely impersonal. They relativize devotion for the purposes of impersonal realization. But I think this is not at that level. This is proper devotional service, but the motivation is not pure. It's not pure devotional service. Okay, we go to the 3rd verse. Okay, also still from the Yajurveda. Yuktvaya manasa devan suvaryato diyadivam vihajyoti karishyataha savita pasuvatitam. We also turn our minds with devotion to the divine souls who have attained the transcendental kingdom of the Lord. We concentrate our meditation on Him. Okay, wait, there's a mistake here. I have to fix. Yeah. Okay, this sentence, it says, we concentrate our meditation on Him, the bright light of infinite transcendence. And the last sentence, the inspirer of all, He especially inspires the great souls. I'm sorry I didn't give this correction before. We have to invert this. It should say, first, the inspirer of all, He especially inspires the great souls who concentrate their meditation on Him, the bright light of infinite transcendence. My translation was wrong. I'll say that again, or everyone have that? You understand? Okay. Let me read it again then. We also turn our minds with devotion to the divine souls who have attained the transcendental kingdom of the Lord. The inspirer of all, He especially inspires the great souls who concentrate their meditation on Him, the bright light of infinite transcendence. So here is revealed the understanding that to approach the Lord, you have to approach His devotees. We now turn our minds with devotion to the devotees of the Lord. With their blessings and with their guidance, we can approach the Lord. This is affirmed in the Vaishnava commentaries. These persons, suvar yataha, yata means gone, participle. Those who have gone to swarga, those who have already attained the spiritual world, we engage our minds in meditating on them. And the old commentary of the Sri Vaishnavas and also the new commentary both say this is the eternal associates of the Lord, the pure Vaishnavas. The Sri Vaishnavas call the Lord's associates, his parshadas, they call them suris, nitya suris, the eternal nitya siddha devotees, especially those who live in Vaikuntha. Especially the previous acharyas, or the great souls referred to here. By following in the footsteps of the acharyas and following the process that they taught, will attain success. It says, Beho Jyoti Karisyata, that these, literally it says that they created the fire, just like the sacrificers who churn the fire and establish it on the altar. But this means that they were successful in their meditation, the great souls, the great acharyas of the past. They successfully realized the Supreme Lord. And they installed that fire of transcendental realization in their own hearts. It is the Savita, the supreme inspirer of all, who gave them that spiritual potency. The great devotees of the past were successful by the mercy of the Supreme Lord. And the mercy of the Supreme Lord is received through their mercy. Very significant. This is basic principle of devotional service. Of course, someone can read the Yajurveda, these verses from the Yajurveda, and try to make some other interpretation. You can avoid, it's certainly possible to avoid a devotional interpretation. But this is the most straightforward and the clearest way of understanding what these verses mean. And at least the Vaishnava commentators all agree that this is the basic meaning of these verses. Although there's one other interpretation of the word deva here. Deva can mean the senses. Rather than the great devotees and the acharyas of the past, another level of looking at it, a different interpretation, is that devas mean the senses of the individual person who's meditating. Because this is also fairly common usage of the word deva in the Upanishads. It means the demigods who control the senses And by extension, by figurative extension, it means the senses themselves. They're called devas. So this could be a prayer simply for directing one's senses toward the Supreme Lord. By withdrawing the senses from matter, one can turn them toward the Lord. And then the Supreme Lord becomes manifest in one's heart, to one's intelligence. May the Supreme Lord, Samita Pasavati Tan, may he give inspiration to them, the devas, which in this case means the senses. May the Lord inspire our senses to successfully turn toward him. Another interpretation. Okay, there's two more verses to read. Also from the Yajurveda. Yes, I'm sorry. Yeah. Object? Okay. The object, there's at least two clauses here. There's three clauses here. The first, the main clause, it's not a main clause, it's a subordinate clause. Engaging with the mind, by the mind engaging the devas. Here it means engaging our senses. The senses are the object in the first subordinate clause, in the first line. Senses are the object. The translation I gave was fixing the senses, directing the senses. Engaging them in meditation. This is not a new idea. It goes back to the first and second verse. Both have the same expression, engaging the senses. Yuktena manasa, when mind engaged. And that's explained in the second verse, for the purpose. Engaged in the direction of liberation, with the goal of liberation. So that's implied, because it's already been stated in the previous verse, for the purpose of attaining Swarga, spiritual kingdom. I reread the fourth verse.
According to the other commentaries, which have been translated as senses and
both commentators give the interpretation of that this means the great souls who are the previous acharyas. Both agree on that. And then the newer commentary gives this as an alternate interpretation. He gives both. The first one gives only the first interpretation. The second one gives both interpretations. So neither of them reject the idea that it means great devotees. This is just an additional way of looking at it. Okay, verse 4. Yunjate mana uta yunjate diyo vipra viprasya vihato vipaschita. Vihotra da deva yunavideka inmahi devasya savituk parishtuti. Okay, further discussion about the great devotees of the past. Self-realized sages fully engage their minds in meditation on the Supreme Absolute, the Omniscient Lord. Indeed, only a person who has true knowledge of the Lord, of the universe, an inspirer of all, can properly praise him through the mantras of sacrifice. Now again, this may sound too devotional, so I'll go over the words and justify it. Yuntatemana, they engage the mind, or their minds. They engage dhiya, which is the commentators say means here, because mind and intelligence are almost the same thing. So here, dhiya is understood as meaning meditation. We engage our minds, they engage their minds, they engage their meditation. Vipra, the self-realized souls. Vipra means learned Brahman. And the commentators say it means those who are self-realized. And then vipra is again occurring, the second word in the second line. They engage their minds in the vipra. The vipras engage their minds in the vipra. So the second vipra is interpreted by Bhagavad Manuja as meaning from the verb pur, to fill, the absolute, complete Lord, who comprises everything. Brahman, the absolute truth, who is everything. Brihata, the word that is right there, Brihata, which is synonymous with Brahman, the absolute, complete, supreme. Vipaschita. Vipaschit means all-knowing. So the omniscient, supreme controller who is everything. And then in the fourth line, he's called Deva again. So he's identified as a person. And he's Mahideva. Mahi is earth or world. He's the personal, supreme lord of the whole world. Jagannath, lord of the universe. That's how he's characterized. And they fix their minds, engage their minds and their meditation on him by Hotra. Vidade means fixed. Hotra. The commentators give two ways of understanding this. Hota is literally the priest of the Rig Veda, the first priest in the sacrifice. Just like the Yajurveda priest is the magician who creates with his magic wands and his mantras. He creates, it turns ordinary things into sacrificial paraphernalia. He creates the whole sacrifice. He creates the transcendental environment. The Rig Veda priest, the Hota, or the Hota and his assistants, they are the masters of ceremonies. They invite all the guests. They offer prayers to invite the demigods to come to the sacrifice. And when they come, they greet them and offer praise to the demigods. Just like the butler at a party, you know, announces, you know, Lord Indra has just arrived, you know, and he offers glorification of Lord Indra. Sends out the invitations and then greets the guests. That's the purpose of the hotel. To invite the demigods and glorify them. Offer them seats and suitable praise. Yes, Paul?
What's the theme of the Rig Veda?
Theme of the Rig Veda is glorification of the demigods. But in the sacrificial context, when the Rig Veda is used in sacrifice, it goes, we need the demigods to come and accept the offerings. So we have to invite them nicely and you know, show them proper hospitality when they can arrive. Yes. So Hotra literally means the priest himself. Or it can mean the whole process of sacrifice. Just like we call the sacrifice Agni Hotra. Either it means by the priest or by the process of offering sacrifice. The great sages of the past engaged their minds and their meditation on worshipping the supreme, absolute person, the omniscient Lord, who's the controller of the whole universe, who's Savita, the inspirer of everybody's intelligence. Through the agency of the priest, or by the process of sacrifice, they offer to the Lord Parishtutihi, which means glorification, praise. Stuti means praise. Paristuti means elaborate praise. So I think the translation is justified. Self-realized sages fully engage their minds in meditation on the Supreme Absolute, the Omniscient Lord. Indeed, only a person... Oh, okay. Eka, I left out one word, Eka. Only, I left out two words, Vayunamit Eka. Only, this is in the singular. We had, the first two lines were talking about vipras, self-realized persons in general. Then it gets more specific and says, only that person, Eka, who is Vayanavit, who possesses, Vit here means possesses, and Vayana means spiritual knowledge or mystical knowledge. Only the person who possesses spiritual knowledge is capable of doing this, of through Hotra, through this priest or through the sacrifice, offering proper prayer, properly glorifying the Supreme. Person who is not thus qualified, who doesn't have transcendental knowledge, is not qualified. He's not capable of properly praising the Supreme. This is also another very important basic principle of devotional service. You just had the principle of the previous verse that you have to approach the Lord through his devotees. And now it says you have to have tattva again. You can't approach just sentimentally. It's for lack of knowledge of these two principles that most people who are attracted to Krishna fail to become pure devotees. Because they're not getting the mercy of the Paramahamsas. They're following the wrong people. And they're following sentimentally without cultivating scientific knowledge of God. And without that, you can be a devotee, but you cannot become a perfect pure devotee. Without getting the dust of the lotus feet of the Paramahamsa pure devotees, and without having to forgive. And that point is made in these two prayers. Very important devotional principles. Let me see if I missed anything here. Yes? I'm sorry. Okay. Let's just read the last verse and we'll have a few minutes. This is a very famous prayer, this last one, which is also from this section. These are all five verses that occur together at the beginning of the 11th chapter of the White Yajurveda. This is the most famous of those five verses. Yujevam vavapurvyam namo vir vishloka etu patyeva surehe shrinvantu vishwe amitasya putra aye damani divyani tastu. O sons of the immortal who dwell in his effulgent abode, please hear my prayer. I offer this with humble obeisances to the Supreme, the predecessor of all of you, hoping to achieve union with him. May my sincere prayer reach him. May it be suitable, as are the prayers of the pure devotees. The word Suri is there, the prayers of the Suris. Suri is the same term that's used by the Sri Vaishnavas to mean the liberated souls who live in Vaikuntha, the Lord's personal associates. Someone who wants to be critical can argue that maybe this wasn't what it was meant to mean in the Yajurveda. If we take the viewpoint, the Yajurveda is the first attempt at approaching the higher truth by primitive people who were worshipping the raw forces of nature and who had no spiritual vision, then we could argue like that. But if we accept that the Vedic vision is one, that the same intelligence that wrote the Bhagavatam, or the same intelligence from which emanates the Bhagavatam, is also the intelligence that produces the Vedas, which is, it's all one unified vision, then there's no reason why we can't agree that Suri means the pure devotees, liberated personal associates of the Supreme Person. It can mean just an inspired sage. The Western historians, the acknowledgers will say that these tribal nomads had shamans, medicine men, who probably were smoking some sort of weed and had some sort of visions, and they were accepted as the visionaries. These were the Suris or the Bards. That's when you want to look at it like that, you can. Okay, this very famous image, O sons of the immortal. These are the eternally liberated devotees of the Lord who are living with the Lord in his abode. And the Rishi of the Yajurveda is here praying that the words of praise that he's offering here may be effective the same way that whatever is spoken by the pure devotees is effective. He's asking for the blessings of his transcendental predecessors to be successful in glorifying the Supreme Person. May they listen to my prayer because this is a sincere prayer, Vishloka, special prayer, specially qualified prayer that does not deviate from the principles of devotional service, bona fide prayer. So it's very important. This five verse passage establishes that before you practice meditation, before you practice yoga, you have to offer your glorification to the Supreme Lord to get his blessings and the blessings of his devotees. Even if your motivation is just some material success or personal liberation, without a tinge of devotion, you won't be successful. And worship of the Supreme is not done independently or whimsically. It has to be done following the footsteps of the previous acharyas. And the principal element of this yoga, of this meditation, is namas, offering obeisances. The real purpose of all Vedic disciplines is to submit oneself to higher authority. That's why one is taught to perform sacrifices. Not so much, although you can say the demigods are fed by our offering them oblations and sacrifice. You could argue they go hungry if we don't feed them. But that's only one way of looking at the purpose. Someone else will offer sacrifice if you don't. But we need to accept spiritual authority. We have to be taught one way or another to do this. And the first process for those who are grossly covered by ignorance, that's recommended for teaching the conditioned soul to accept spiritual authority in the process of Vedic sacrifice. By accepting the principles and submitting oneself to that process, one learns to respect the authority of the demigods, of the Vedic literature itself, of the sages who are the authorities of the Vedas, and of the Brahmins. This is very, very important. By accepting those authorities, one is coming closer to being able to accept the authority of the Supreme Person and his pure devotees. And the words spoken in this portion of the Yajurveda reveals an elevated understanding that of the importance of this submission. Namas means to bow your head down. Namas, namo, you know, Mahavada Nyayam, like that, means I offer my respectful obeisances. The same meaning is here. Namobi is obey, namo, and namobi means with obeisances. Means respectful obeisances. I am bowing down because I admit that you're a better person than me. So I'm submitting myself to your authority. With that attitude, it's possible to actually begin the process of meditation. Otherwise, there's no sense proceeding. That emphasis is made, that point is made very emphatically here in these first verses. Okay, any questions? Okay, let me try to justify that. Yuj. The word yuj, you can say that's synonymous with yoga, comes from the same verb. Yoga is a noun that comes from the verb yuj, which means to join or connect. Yoga means connection. Yuj means connection too, it's just the alternate word. Yuj means for connection. So, for the purpose of becoming connected, is the most literal translation. Of course, that same verb and different forms of it have occurred in every single verse in this chapter so far. And so we have something to rely on. We can go back and see what they're talking about. Yuktena Manasan, the second verse, we're connecting our mind in the process of worship to the Supreme Lord for the purpose of attaining Swarga, for the purpose of attaining his kingdom. So, the connection is connection to devotional service for the purpose of attaining the spiritual world. That's pretty explicit. So although it's not, here it just says for connecting, we go back to the previous verses, we get a more complete idea of what connecting to what, for what purpose. Okay. And it's yoga. Now this is the process of yoga. That's described in all the scriptures. There's so many explanations of what yoga is. Okay, anything else? Yes, ma'am.
One thing came up in the Shambhala Sutra. Your definition should be beginning of the course. Could you, which paper, what was the bottom line of
Officially, all the Puranas are only Smriti. They're secondary literatures. But Jiva Goswami is an explanation in the Tathagatasandarbha that unofficially, confidentially, among us, we can understand the Bhagavatam is actually Smriti. And that means that the words of the Bhagavatam never change. Even when it's spoken in different ages, it's forgotten and then spoken again. Same exact words, not one word of it has changed. And so thus, when Shukadeva Goswami heard the Bhagavatam from yesterday, he heard the whole Bhagavatam, including the parts that he speaks, he heard from his own father before he spoke them. Because the Bhagavatam is eternal, this speaking occurs, you know, periodically. And that's Shruti. Smriti is different. The other Puranas may be spoken in different words, in different ages. Eternal, unchanged scripture. It doesn't have any author. Nobody composed the actual words of it. It's eternally existing.
So why do they
because it's a Purana, and the Puranas are popular histories of the universe, written in simple language for common people. The Shruti are meant only to be studied and taught and even heard by properly qualified Brahmins. It says in the various places, if a Shudra even hears the Vedic mantras, then he'll go to hell, and whoever let him hear it will go to hell also. Even Baladeva Dibhushan, the Govinda Bhash, agrees with that opinion. The Shudra should not even be allowed to hear the Vedic mantras. Of course, we can make anyone into a Brahmin by training him up in the Vaishnava. But a person who has no spiritual qualification, who's an ordinary materialist, he should not even hear these mantras. But the Puranas are meant for Sri Shudra Dvijabandhu, for ordinary people in this age. People without rabbinical qualification can hear the Puranas. So they're secondary literatures, popularized versions of the Vedic knowledge. This is special mercy of the sages, especially Vyasadeva, that they presented the Puranas so that everybody could have access to spiritual knowledge.
So, if the words are changed to Shruti, then the essence is lost.
Well, the empowered sage who has the authority to speak Smriti, he puts his name on it, it's his composition, so whatever it is his fault. Yeah, but the rishis who put their names on the different Vedic hymns are just considered transmitters. They didn't, even though they put their name on the top, each Vedic mantra has a rishi attached to it, or each section of each prayer. You know, we know who the rishi is. Kanva Rishi, Shonaka Rishi, you know, each one has a name on it. They're the people who saw the heard the mantras in their meditation, but they're not considered the authors.